Just give it a second. Yeah.
So what I was saying was that, yes, one may have to pick and choose. One should definitely look at the terms of reference carefully. One is not being inveigled into actually doing something really, really, egregiously wrong or counter, sort of not very progressive. But beyond that, I think there's also an argument that several people have made to me. When I, in fact, I was asked to be on the coal mining committee, I consulted some friends saying, does it make sense for me to be there? And halfway through, I was even very frustrated. I was thinking about stepping down because I was so upset with the whole process. And several friends said, no, please stay on, because if you are not there, they'll put somebody who's, completely not interested in many of the issues that we need to be focusing on. So at least you can contribute something. You can make their voice heard, etc. So it's sort of an argument that if you don't get onto it, then somebody, quote unquote, worse or with, let's say, less progressive views might get onto it. So that's one argument made. But I think one can also think about it a little bit more broadly, in the sense, if the issue is about decision making on environmental issues, then decisions are not necessarily made only in this linear manner between, where scientists speak to policymakers or to decision makers, and then they make decisions. That's not the only way that decisions get made, right? Because these decisions are political, and I mean political in a even in its simplest sense, in the sense that there are interests that are at, tussling over the issue. And they may be legitimate interests, but there is still conflict. Livelihoods versus elephants or whatever, both are legitimate interests, but they are in conflict. So in that sense, political, and therefore the political system often responds better, and we are in a democratic country, so they respond to public pressure, not just the scientific truth. And policy change, especially progressive policy change, may only happen through public movements, civil society efforts, lobbying, talking to political leaders, and maybe they get 25% of what you're trying to say, but at the opportune time, it might actually work. So I think we also have to ask the question, if the real goal is for our knowledge to inform change in terms of decisions, there might be other channels through which it can be done, and that it should be done. And one of the reasons, of course, we use that as an argument to put our information in the public domain, right? We say we must put whatever we generate as knowledge must be in the public domain so that it's accessible to the public. But I think we have to go several steps beyond that. We have to make it much more accessible, put it in layperson language, put it in the local languages. In the Indian context, we were talking about 150 languages. So try to get it into the local press, local languages, simplify it in a way that can, essential science is communicated well, but also reach out to civil society activists who work on these issues, build their understanding of these issues, so feed the knowledge to them, and therefore hopefully through them to the political process. And why not reach out to even political leaders or elected representatives, let me put it that way, right? Whether it's the member of parliament or MLA or whoever, to try to build their understanding of these issues. I mean, those are routes that scientists have traditionally shied away from. Even engaging with civil society actors is seen as activism, whereas engaging on a committee is seen as legitimate because the state has invited you to, the government has invited you to be on the committee, so then you're legitimate. And this is a very, and it's become even worse right now, because right now everybody who engages with, in civil society action is, well, as an urban Nakshal. So then that's even a bigger problem and a big greater fear associated with following that process or going through that route. And this goes to the heart of the question as to whether the state is a benign state, waiting for the right kind of knowledge and then ready to act on it. At the best of the times, the state is still political, and therefore there are different interest groups that are tussling, and knowledge is anyway filtered through normative lenses to come up with certain recommendations, which may or may not match the normative positions of the particular decision makers. So they may take different decisions. That's at the best of times. At the worst of times, it is that the decisions have already been made, they're driven by vested interests, and then you just use the report to kind of give it a scientific painting, in a sense, or painted look scientific. And that happens a lot of the time. It happens a lot of the time. But usually, maybe it's somewhere in between that they pick recommendations that are doable from their political perspective. May not have pre-decided on them, but they'll pick those that they subsequently think are doable and not all of them. But I think we have to really look at go beyond this linear understanding of a benign state waiting for, you know, those who speak truth to power. It's not like that at all. We have to look at the possibility that we are a post-colonial society with huge vestiges of still an anti-democratic setup, a decision-making setup that is really not interested in the well-being of the most marginalized, for example, or even the well-being of the environment, if you want to put it that way, including statutory committees of the Ministry of Environment. Because what I found very quickly was that this was a committee of the Ministry of Environment supposed to do, you know, due diligence on environmental appraisals of different projects. But the larger context was that the Minister of Environment himself saying, you know, read my lips. Our government is about ease of doing business. And he said this very, very openly. So I think that's the context in which one is often operating. And we need to just be very, be alert to it and therefore ask how else can I take knowledge to change?
Mm-hmm. So what you described just now, you know, in terms of different ways in which you need to get the knowledge out there and, you know, your engagement with the committees, is this in the sense what you mean by when you say scholar activist, that this would what you would call a scholar activist? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think as I said, in the field of environment or, for example, any other applied research context, whether it is in culture or poverty or whatever, we have a normative concern which is driving our work. Mm-hmm. And so I think almost by definition, we are anyway activists. In the sense, if I write a journal paper on the drivers of poverty, mm-hmm. right, then I'm saying upfront that poverty is a bad thing and we need to get rid of it. And these are some of the ways that it might be happening, or these are the ways to deal with mm-hmm. it. So to me, that itself is a validated statement, you know. But then why not look at the larger picture in terms of where this knowledge is going or not going, how far it is going, how far it is not going. Is it falling on the right ears? What is the meaning of the right ears? Does it have to be only people with power, or actually in a democratic country, it's got to be everybody? And I think we need to look at those steps. And therefore, the activist element becomes stronger because we are critically examining this assumption that, oh, if I just put out a paper, even in the, you know, Journal of whatever, Economic and Political Weekly or something, I've done my job. Yeah. And then some bureaucrat will read it and they will act on it. And that's a very, I think, a very glib assumption. And the moment you question that, then you have to become more of an activist in the sense of simply taking that knowledge into different arenas very actively. I think it's not necessarily about being activist. Well, on certain issues, I think if you feel strongly, then you end up advocating certain positions, no doubt. Mm. We are always advocating positions, right? When we say, as I said, when you say that, these are the policy measures to be taken for removing poverty. It's a question of my science telling me what causes poverty and my values telling me that poverty is a bad thing.
It's
right. So I'm anyway being a bit of an advocate. So I think it's just about understanding that scholarship doesn't, or even shall we say applied scholarship, cannot end at just putting something out there in some journal paper. And therefore trying to figure out how to engage with those who are agents of change, and there are multiple agents out there, right? And particularly, I think, in a lopsided society where there are such differences in power between the state, civil society, and the actual communities that are affected by this, there's so much economic differentiation, so much differentiation on social lines, that we, you know, we are far from a true democracy. We are kind of a really limited form of a democracy. Voices are just not heard, and so on. So I think, yeah, we need to be much more activist in that sense of getting the message out.
I was wondering that as scientists trained to do this, no? But, and it also seems like something that will probably take scientists
out of their comfort zones. I'm thinking that science tends to draw a certain kind of person. You know, my sense is that someone who likes to work on his or her own sort of introspective, not really out there engaging with people. And I mean, from talking to you and looking at your work, you might be an exception to that. But I'm wondering whether that is a problem, that, you know, you get into science because you're a certain kind of person, but in an applied field, it really requires you to also take on these other roles. And I was wondering how it has been for you personally. Is this something that you, you know, take to naturally, and is, you know, how to do it? Have you just sort of learned on the go?
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right, but it comes from us having this undifferentiated notion of a scientist, right? If I was to, I was told that when you choose to work in the field of environment or conservation biology or something, you're not a scientist, you are an applied scientist. You're not a pure scientist. Mm-hmm. And there is a difference. It comes with a different kind of responsibility, different role, and therefore different skill sets. If we are told that upfront, I think it would make a huge difference. And we are not told that. So we love to just put on that scientist hat because it gives us a certain amount of prestige and power and the way we are socialized, right? So I think there is definitely a problem in the way we are trained, and it's not made explicit to us. I think I was lucky to be slightly differently trained, because when I went to Berkeley to the Energy and Resources Group, the founder of the program, John Holdren, he would run these one-credit seminars for every batch, which were called, I think it was officially called Interdisciplinary Environmental Research as a Profession. And the nickname was Tricks of the Trade. And it was really, so he would teach you everything, how to write journal papers, how to write op-ed pieces, how to make a presentation. You know, so this is not about, this is not your role, how to do research. It's about how to interact with the rest of the world. So how to be a consultant. So if you want to go and set up your consultancy business, what are the challenges and pitfalls and things to know about it? You would bring in people who had gone out and become consultants to, you know, speak in that lecture. How do you manage your time? What does it mean to be interdisciplinary? So there was a whole debate about what does it mean to be interdisciplinary, and so on. So he made a real effort, and I think that's really remarkable, that to both pass on his own learnings, which he must have learned the hard way, because he was a pure physicist when he was trained, to pass it on and to say that, no, he recognized that a master's or a PhD in environmental studies, or what our group was called, energy and resources, was an applied field. People came in with a commitment to change the world. And then they need to be taught some of those skills. You know, and he, okay, he had his own model. And I'm, you know, this is, we are talking about 30, 40 years ago. But that thinking was there. And I think we need that. We need that in every such applied, whether it's master's or PhD program, that you're not doing science. You're doing applied science, applied interdisciplinary science. It comes with values, and you need to translate that into some impact. Then how do you do that translation? And what will it involve? What challenges will you face? Right? How will you negotiate those challenges? And I think even at ATRI, we try that, but we still fall short sometimes. And we've had informal discussions about what does it mean to serve on policy-making committees or you know, these kind of committees. But I think we need to have a much more consistent, shall we say, syllabus about it based on our learnings. So, yes, I think nobody taught me how to write op-ed pieces. I mean, John Holdren did a little bit of that training, but, you know, one session in one semester. I had to then, of course, learn the rest of it on my own, in terms of serving on committees. One interesting comment that I remember still that he made, and this is in 87 that I took the class, was that, remember that in a committee, the person who writes the minutes controls what gets written. You know, that stayed with me because I saw that happening all the time, and I therefore often volunteered to write the minutes because it helped me, you know, make sure that certain ideas were inserted in the decisions and so on. So, you know, just a small things like that, but there's a ton of stuff that we need to learn. And many of us are reinventing the wheel, which is not necessarily the best way to do it. So, yeah, you need that kind of training, no doubt.
Seth, I want to, at this point, ask you a sort of broader, looking back, reflective question on your experiences in, you know, creating knowledge for change. And you've said in different points in this conversation that that's really your primary interest. And I wanted to ask, you know, whether you can look back and talk a little bit about what your learnings have been in this regard. You know, if you compare how you thought about it around the time when you started to now, what have been the most sort of revealing learnings? And I'm interested in it, particularly from the point of view of what increases the likelihood of knowledge being useful, right? You worked in different sectors. You worked in forests and waters, and you know, I'm wondering also from the comparison of how this works in different sectors, whether there are things that you've learned about what might be the conditions under which knowledge is most useful.
So I think we should make a distinction between knowledge being relevant, salient, mm-hmm. potentially impactful, and actually having an impact.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a big gap between being potentially impactful and actually having an impact, because it might be a really well-written report. It really covers the issue well. It's, you know, fully grounded in the reality of the situation, etc., and may still be thrown into the dustbin, given the, mm-hmm. especially if it's a report submitted to government or something. So that difference between an impactful, potentially impactful report and an actual impact, that gap mm-hmm. is determined by what's going on out there,
mm-hmm.
Which we have very little control over, very little, maybe a little bit, you know, did you go and sort of harangue the minister about it? Did you try to, so did you build alliances with, as I said, civil society groups who are working on it? You know, make them your allies in disseminating and kind of lobbying for this change, etc. Right? I'll give you another example of that, which is, you know, I was on this task group for water policy in Karnataka. And as a member secretary and the chair was Mihir Shah, we argued with the Karnataka Knowledge Commission, which was supporting this work or which had set up this task group, that it's not enough for us to write an English report. This is the mm-hmm. state of Karnataka and the lay people understand Kannada. And it's our duty to write a draft and then get it translated into Kannada and go out and have public hearings on the draft, which is mm-hmm. a two-way process of making people aware that such an exercise is going on, what is being drafted in that exercise, and getting inputs and feedback. So it's also sort of building the discourse around it. Mm-hmm. And the Karnataka Knowledge Commission, imagine this is the Knowledge Commission, gave a flat no. No to translation. No to dissemination. It's not our job. Mm-hmm. The government has asked us to do this. We're just going to do it for government.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that part of the story is also important. We may still never have had an impact. We could have done all those things and maybe it would have still been junked by government because the vested interests in the sector are very, very strong. But I'm just saying, I'm not sure we did the whole whatever that, mm-hmm. that could have been done. But coming back to the question of how do we do the research or how do we do the knowledge generation, whether it is in a committee or whether it's in individual projects or analysis and so on. I think that's really, I mean, what I learned, I suppose, is there's a difference between relevance and salience.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to earlier frame my work as, you know, it needs to be rigorous and relevant. So academically rigorous and societally relevant. But mm-hmm. I think one needs to go a step further and say that we will face questions about what is more relevant in some sense in a given context, mm-hmm. right? So, for example, in the context of, let's say, forests and the challenges or the contestation over who should control the forest, it might turn out that the ecological data that you might provide may be actually not terribly relevant, because the question is really about who has rights to control the forest. Or you might have to give particular kinds of data about how communities have managed forests that could be called sustainably managed. And if you did instead research on, you know, sort of basic dynamics of ecological dynamics of the forest, is it relevant to the problem of forest management? Yes. Because at some point that knowledge is going to be useful to somebody, perhaps. Is it salient? Probably not. It's a very small piece of the puzzle. So making a distinction between the big holes and the small holes, which we do in a sense even in normal science, you know, in basic science, there are debates about what are the hot topics, what are the big unknowns, etc.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's harder to figure that out in the applied science and in an interdisciplinary applied arena to figure that out, because one is in a sense being filtered by different perspectives and so on. So I think Yeah, so my learning has been one that we need to really start thinking of what are the salient questions or the salient or the big holes. Some of them may be knowledge related, some of them may be more translation related, in the sense there exists knowledge but it's lost in translation or it's not been taken to the right audiences. Some of it might be collating several people's work and putting it out there in a way that kind of has more impact or is more, as I said, potentially impactful. But the salience question, I think, is important for us to keep in mind, that when we choose questions, they should not just be relevant. They need to be some of the most pressing questions or the most debated ones, most relevant to that topic. Because we are often, unfortunately, still tools-driven and discipline-driven, right? So I'll say, well, I just know how to study forest ecological dynamics. So I'm just going to study that, and I can always make an argument that, well, in any forest management, ecological dynamics is important. And I think we often slip into that temptation, and that's really, really, something to watch out against. So that was one thing. And the other thing for me as a learning in terms of what kind of work can be, as I said, potentially more impactful, I think we have to also try to think in terms of impact. And one thing that I learned from my colleagues in CICD, we had hot debates about some of these questions. Is academic journal publishing, useful at all? Is looking at some of the theoretical discussions useful at all? And I think I must say that I had probably a much more kind of applied position, saying, no, my knowledge is only useful if it goes out into the public domain and is, legible to the common person, etc. And I continue to hold that that's an important function that I need to, play. But I also see the value of engaging with some of the bigger theoretical positions in academia and kind of debating them, because that's how knowledge is created. It's through those frameworks that knowledge is created. And one could potentially influence the direction of knowledge creation in the applied domain. In a way that is important, because ultimately it's still public money that's being invested in the applied domain, and maybe it's not going in the best direction. So for example, my engagement with questions of whether the ecosystem services framework is the right framework to use, etc., have been driven by that kind of concern, that some frameworks become really powerful, but if they have major holes or major errors, they are driving research in a particular direction, which is really not fruitful. And that's important. You might say, I'm sure the activists would say, these are your internal academic debates. They're going to go nowhere as far as the real world is concerned. And I think maybe the jury's sort of still out on that. I have changed my position in terms of saying there is some value in engaging in these academic debates, but one has to be careful, because academia is still sucking us into the publications game. And that's only getting worse. So how do we really do that balancing act? I think that's really, really important. And it's only becoming worse and worse day by day. So that pressure to publish at any cost and publish anything, as long as, because you need to increase the count of publications that you have in your CV, is just horrendous. It's just horrendous and debilitating. So, and that's, I think, a learning in the opposite direction. Sort of, I've seen this. I used to think, when I sort of graduated with my PhD, that really there was a lot of space for people to do interdisciplinary applied work, speak to policymakers, speak to the lay public. There was also maybe a sort of a rosy period, 1982, as I mentioned earlier, was the publication of the Citizens Report on State of India's Environment, a coalition of scholars and activists and journalists all working together. So I think that definitely shaped my thinking, saying this is how things are going to change. And over time, I see the environmental movement fragmenting and getting professionalized, and people retreating into their individual silos and professions, and kind of it becoming another career. And I think that those are some of the pitfalls.